John Hartson was known as a hard man of football. He signed for Luton Town aged 16 and went on to become a goal machine for 8 different clubs and his country, Wales, being managed by and playing alongside some of the biggest names in football. So let's go back to the beginning. Tell us about your upbringing and your family.
Well, I had a brilliant upbringing in Swansea, one of 4 children, my brother and my 2 sisters. We lived in a council house all my life, basically running around the streets and youth club and play scheme and the school holidays and all this stuff. Really, really happy upbringing. My mum and dad never ever laid a finger on us physically or, my dad was the boss of the house. He was the breadwinner. But saying that, my mum worked in the psychiatric hospital, which is a really difficult job, you know, dealing with people that have been taken off the streets because they're psychotic and they need 24-hour care. So my mum had a really difficult, and she worked nights. But my mum and dad, fantastic. They did everything for us, to try and make sure that, you know, we had a holiday every summer. My dad used to have this old van and he had a roof rack and we'd all jump in the back of the van and he'd put the cases on the roof rack and we'd go down to, say, Tenby in West Wales and we'd go and stay in a caravan because we never went abroad and places like this. But I have to say my upbringing was brilliant and my parents couldn't have been any nicer to us.
And supportive as well. They encouraged you into football, particularly your dad. And it was 16 years old when you signed for Luton Town. So your mum and dad drive you down to Luton and drop you off. What's it like as a footballer in that situation? Is it exciting or scary?
Well, it was a great opportunity for me because I'd had these dreams as a young boy growing up in Swansea to hopefully get an opportunity to go to a football club at 16 to start what you'd call an apprenticeship or a scholarship or a YTS scheme. And I got an opportunity at Luton and then I went up there at 16, lived with a family. And at 17, I'd made an immediate impact on the football club and I got into the first team very young. But Luton was a great upbringing. It was old school in terms of we had to clean the stands and we had to clean the players' boots. We all got a professional that we had. Every single one of the youth team players had to personally get his kit out for him, make sure his boots were shining for everyday training. The youth team coach used to go around the top of the dressing room, the hooks, and just run his finger for dust and things like that. I always remember that vaguely. My youth team coach, Terry Wesley, who was always great for me. Terry's working now at West Ham with the under-21s, I believe. But Luton was great. Luton was just a really special place because it was where it all started. And David Pleat then, of course, gave me my debut at 19.
And it wasn't long before the big clubs were looking at you and you moved to Arsenal, the most expensive teenager in British history, £2.5 million. George Graham's Arsenal, and what a team you joined.
It was a great team. It was almost, well, it was the England back four. It was David Seaman, Dixon Adams, Keown, Boldy, Winterburn, John Jensen, Ray Parler, Merson, Bergkamp, Wright, Smith, Campbell, Selly. Great, great club. And they were fantastic with me. I was only 19. I was walking in that dressing room. And I remember George Graham said to me on the Friday I signed, he took me upstairs, we come through the marble halls, Highbury, the marble floors, and went upstairs into Ken Fryer's office. And George is there, and he said, John, he said, Kevin Campbell's got injured this morning. Alan Smith is struggling with his knee. He said, if you sign for me today, son, he said, you'll play out there on Highbury. There was sort of glass in the office, and he could look in onto Highbury. He said, if you sign for me today, he says, you'll play out there tomorrow with the current England centre-forward, who, of course, was Ian Wright. Mm. So I basically said, right, well, where's the contract, you know? It wasn't really about money. I never even thought about money back then. I was 19. I was going to make money during my career. And I signed, and I made my debut on that Saturday. We played Everton, playing against my big mate, Neville Southall, who was in goal for Everton. Duncan Ferguson got sent off for Everton and Ian Wright scored the goal for us and we drew the game 1-1. So that was me made my debut on the Saturday, quickly pushed into the team, got to quickly know the lads. Tony Adams was brilliant, brilliant captain, a real man amongst men. Everybody loved Tony. And Wrighty and then Bergkamp joined then the following season. So Arsenal was just great, great memories. We got to the UEFA Cup Winners' Cup final and managed to get a goal, the famous goal, Naeem from the halfway line. Beat the world's number one goalkeeper at the time, David Seaman. So that was a bit of a shame, but Arsenal was great, great memories.
And George Graham wasn't there too long after you signed. He left under quite controversial circumstances and Bruce Rioch took over. What was your relationship like with him?
Not great with Bruce. I don't know why, but we just didn't quite get on as well as we should have, really, manager and player. I was very young. I was very boisterous. I played with Bruce's son, Greg, in the Luton youth team. So I knew Bruce before he came to Arsenal. I used to go down to his house in Harpenden with his son, Greg, and Bruce's wife, Greg's mum, used to make us food and things like that. And I don't know whether Greg got, I think he went on to Wigan, or he might, don't think he had a too successful career. Not being disrespectful, Greg, I love Greg Rioch, he's a good lad. But maybe it was because maybe Bruce, I was at Arsenal, and Greg maybe was a little bit further down the ladder. And I just felt he was a bit personal, some of the stuff that he used to do to me and say to me. Maybe looking back, you know, maybe I was a little bit young, a bit paranoid. And maybe I should have done things a little bit better. But we didn't see eye to eye. We never quite got on. So the day that Bruce was sacked, I was really overjoyed, without sounding disrespectful or nasty. I just felt I could make a fresh start now under a manager that I could go and impress the new manager. And from Bruce Rioch, it was Arsene Wenger. And I had a brilliant relationship with Arsene Wenger. Me and Wrighty played up top and Dennis played in the hall several times. He never wanted me to leave Arsenal. Arsene Wenger, there was a new contract on the table there that I only needed to go and see David Dean, and it was ready there, a new contract at Arsenal for me to sign. But I had Harry Redknapp and West Ham on the phone. They wanted to sign me at 21, and I eventually ended up going to West Ham.
Just going back to Arsene Wenger, though, he came in with some quite new ways that have probably been rolled out more across the board now. But what did you make of them at the time? And what sort of things did he do that might have surprised you?
Well, he just basically, Arsene Wenger, the training became more structured. He did everything with a watch. We would do 6 or 7 laps of the training ground every morning before we started training, just to get the lactic acid out of your body and your legs. Great coach, would take players 1v1, clearly very, very intelligent. I never heard him swear once, a complete gentleman. And the players loved him. The players absolutely loved him. The senior players as well. And I think they will now say to you themselves that Arsene Wenger added 2 or 3 years on top of their careers, because they really tuned into the diet, the foods that we were getting, the stretching after training every day. We'd go into a room and Arsene Wenger would stand in the middle. We would form a big circle and he'd go through all the stretches, and the lads tuned in to the philosophy that what Arsene wanted. And what was a bit of a shame, really, was I left Arsenal. It wasn't a shame, because I'm happy I went to West Ham, because I had a good time there. And I worked with some great players. And obviously, Harry Redknapp has become a great friend of mine over the years. Harry, who signed me. But I left Arsenal in 97, and they won the double in 98. So if I'd stayed and been a bit more patient, because it was Wrighty and Dennis that was keeping me out, Dennis Bergkamp, obviously, and Ian Wright, two of the greatest at the time. I might have been sitting here with a double winner's medal now, and I'd have played with the great Henri and Petit, and Vieira was there, of course. I forgot to say Patrick then was in the squad. So it was one of them things, you know, I can't do nothing about it now, but maybe if I know now what I might have known at 21, I may well have stayed at Arsenal for a few more years.
But Harry Redknapp came along and he offered you first team football every week, guaranteed.
Yeah.
You seem to be a player that kind of thrives on confidence in you.
I'm a confidence person. I think most of us are. If I walk into a room, even now, I'll go and sit at the back. I won't necessarily sit at the front. You know, I think we all thrive on a bit of confidence. We all work better when we're confident. I've done shows for television companies and I'm not too comfortable with the presenter and I'm not as confident and I don't come across as well. And then I go to another show, me and the presenter, we're good friends. He asks me the right things. He brings me in at the right times and I'm flying and I come across great and I'm relaxed and I can deal with the cameras and things like this. So I think we all thrive a little bit on confidence. I was quite shy, believe it or not. Whenever the manager dug me out in the dressing room, I'd go bright red and I'd go a little bit embarrassed. But in time, obviously, I picked up a lot more confidence as the years have gone by with some of the clubs I'd played for and everything else that you just have to get on with your life. And sometimes you've got to be confident for your kids, you know. But I struggled with confidence initially early on. But then Harry gave me the confidence to go and lead the line at West Ham, be the main player, built his team around me, and I had great success there, especially that first season with 24 goals, which was my best in the Premier League.
You rewarded him with lots of goals, and you guys had a great relationship. Of course, he's now the king of the jungle.
That's right.
Have you spoken to him about it?
I haven't spoken to him. I probably couldn't get hold of him. He's probably really busy. I've heard he's doing the new book and everything, but good luck to him. You know, he's a great guy.
Did you watch it?
I watched snippets of it, yeah. My wife's a big fan, she watches it, she tapes it and everything. So I was delighted for him because he is, you know, he showed the public that softer side to him, and I think everybody's fallen in love with him since the jungle. But no, he was great when he signed me back then, you know, long time ago now, seems like a long time ago. He gave me the confidence, as I said, and he's a character. We used to go to Walthamstow Dogs together on a Thursday night, me and Harry Redknapp, my manager. Harry would have, you know, we'd both have a little bit of a steak. I'd have a glass of Coke. He'd have a glass of wine. And, you know, we liked a little bet back then. That's common knowledge. But it was, you know, that's the type of relationship we had. You know, players wouldn't see Pep Guardiola going to the Manchester dog track with Raheem Sterling, would you?
Definitely not, no. Unfortunately.
But back then, you know, there was no cameras, there was none of this social media, all this sort of stuff. And Harry could meet me, you know, in a hotel and we'd go to the dogs and we'd come home and nobody would know about it apart from the people that were there. So that was great.
It was around that time that you also became a bit of a man to watch for the tabloids. You got yourself involved in a few incidents, including a late night incident in a bar with your uncle.
I know.
Firmly leading you astray. Harry say, though, about that?
Well, he wasn't too happy about it. And I just think, you know, going through a career, you know, some things I regret. But I think a lot of it as well shapes you for what you are, I think. You know, I'm now 43. I think the one good thing about getting older is that you get a bit wiser. You make better decisions. You keep better company. You tend to leave at the right time and you don't go to certain places that potentially, you know, can be a bit of a nightmare. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, you're first in there, you're last out. You know, I grew up on a council estate with a group of guys that, you know, like to have a drink and go out and enjoy themselves. And for a long time, I remained one of the boys. And I did things that they did, although I was a professional footballer. But knowing what I know now, as you say, a bit more mature, a bit more grown up. But at that particular time, you know, you make mistakes. You do make mistakes along the way. And I made a few. But, you know, over the piece, over the career, there's not a lot of things I would regret.
You stole a hanging basket, got you in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, I know, but there's 30 hanging baskets that'll be stolen this weekend and it won't get a mention because it's John Hartson, because I'm in Swansea. Let's get him in. Let's make a headline of this one.
Probably the worst of it, and I would assume one of your biggest regrets was the incident with Eyal Berkovic on the training grounds.
That was...
He made it to the press.
That was a really a regrettable incident because although I was physical, I was quite aggressive. I enjoyed that physical side of the game. It was wrong to lash out and do what I did to Ayle. Although he hit me first, if you look at the video, he threw a punch at me, and then I reacted in the wrong way. It was on camera. Somebody had filmed it. Somebody then went and put it out there. It went viral, and I had a lot of bad publicity. And you know, I felt for my family because they were not used to that. You know, there was press knocking my parents' door in Swansea and things like this. But it was a lesson, and as I said, I've not got that many regrets. But that was an incident that I wish hadn't happened. And I always felt that slightly went before me then. I was 21. It was like more than half my lifetime ago. I'm 43 now. And people, you know, my 30-odd goals in 60-odd games for West Ham, and I played my part in keeping them up. People tend to not mention the good things. People like to sort of revel in the misdemeanours. For Roy Keane, all Roy's magnificent career, people like to talk about when he walked away from Ireland and when he ended up playing his career. It's like, talk about the good things. I've always had to answer them questions because I think people generally like to know about, you know, the stuff that went wrong. Do you know what I mean? But as I said, I've held my hands up. I take full responsibility for that incident, and it's one that I did regret and look back and think I wish it never happened.
A moment of madness.
Absolutely.
Possibly was a factor in you leaving West Ham. You went to Wimbledon next, where I'd imagine the antics on the training ground were much more sedate.
Well, they were, but what happens on the training ground stays on the training ground, as you know. But there was a great bunch of lads. Obviously, I'd missed the crazy gang era in terms of Dennis Wise and Vinnie Jones and Fash and Dave Besant, all the guys that were there at the time. But we still had some great characters. We had Marcus Gale, we had Robbie Earle, who was brilliant, Ben Thatcher, Andy Roberts, Alan Kimball, Kenny Cunningham, Neil Sullivan, Carl Court. Great lads, really, really. Neil Ardley, of course, who's just moved out of his post as a Wimbledon manager, gone up to Notts County. Neil was a great lad, good player. But we had great fun. Joe Kinnear paid an awful lot of money for me, £7.5 million, and Sam Haman, which almost shook the football world at the time. It was so much money. And you look back now, you know, that was 1999. And what's that? It's like 20 years ago. That's 85 million now in today's market, yeah. You know, if you think of the years. So I had a few injuries at Wimbledon.
Tough time there.
A little bit of a tough time there, yeah. And my little girl was born in Hatfield. I was living in Brookmans Park. I was driving right the way around the M25 to go training every day. And but nothing but good times again, really. Had a few injury problems. We got relegated. I commented again on that relegation, which I should have kept my big mouth shut, really. Egil Olsen came to the club, who was an absolute gentleman. He really, really was. He had a certain style of playing. He loved a big centre forward, so that suited my style. They got the ball from front to back really quickly. Myself, Marcus Gale and Carl Court were the three up front, 3 6 foot, three, you know, big guys. So Wimbledon was an experience, but again, no regrets about joining Wimbledon. I went as well for Joe Kinnear, Mick Arford, who was my hero, he was a coach. So no regrets about going to Wimbledon.
It was when you came to leave Wimbledon that problems started occurring in your career, problems that you didn't expect at the time. And on the pitch, obviously, it was difficult. I think four clubs you were going to sign for that turned you down because you failed a medical when you thought you had no problems. And off the pitch, that was a really hard time for you.
It was, because I'm thinking, there's nothing wrong with my knee here. I'm doing all the training, I'm doing all the drills that's expected of me in training. But whenever you scanned my knee, something showed up that made put the clubs off signing me, because they thought, this knee ain't going to last. You know, it's something there. Medically, it didn't stand up to what was the criteria, what they were looking for. And I failed a big medical at Spurs for £7 million. So that would have meant I was going Arsenal, West Ham, Wimbledon, Spurs. Failed that medical, Dr. King, David Pleat, chief executive, George Graham, manager, Alan Sugar, chairman. Spent the day having a medical, failed that one. I would have gladly have signed for Spurs. Wouldn't have bothered me about playing for other London clubs. It would have been a proud moment for me. Then I went to Rangers, Glasgow Rangers, which, again, the way things have worked out, my 5 years, my 110 goals for Celtic,
yeah.
They're big rivals. That was probably, looking back, one of the best things that have happened to me. But at the time, it really hurt to fail the medical. Because if I hadn't have failed that medical, I wouldn't have had the chance to sign for Celtic and had the career that I had and the success I had playing for Celtic. Charlton, Alan Kirbishley, spent the day with Alan Kirbishley, failed that medical. And then I failed the medical initially at Coventry. And then Coventry then did a deal with Wimbledon that they pay Wimbledon as I play. And I had a brilliant 6 months for Coventry, proved my fitness. And then in the summer, we went down at Coventry, got relegated. In that summer, I went to Celtic and joined Martin O'Neill for £6 million, which was great.
And you were literally hero worshipped at Celtic, weren't you? Was the feeling mutual?
Yeah, I love the club. It's a special club. The fans were unbelievable. When I was ill, they were brilliant. When I was playing there, I had 5 great years. Met my wife Sarah while I was in Glasgow, and it's an unbelievable club. The volume, the size of the fan base worldwide. We had a great team. Got to the UEFA Cup final in 2003. I won 7 trophies. I won 3 league trophies, individual honours for goals, and I thoroughly enjoyed my 5 years with Celtic Football Club. And it's just a great place to play your football.
John Hartson was a tough guy of football with a fiery reputation, a goal machine for club and country. But which of the 8 clubs he played for did he enjoy the most?
I enjoyed everywhere, really, because Celtic, I was probably the most successful. I won trophies. Arsenal, I was very young, and it was a great experience to go in there at 19. I'm still a baby at 19. You don't know anything. And then, you know, I'm playing with Paul Merson, and I'm playing with Dennis Bergkamp. And a year prior to that, I'm playing against Bristol City for Luton under-18s youth team. So, you know, the speed of my development, really, and the place that I was at. I was in Arsenal's first team playing Champions League football, which was just amazing at the time. I probably can't remember most of it because it's so far long ago. And when you're a player, you're in a bubble. You know, you're in a bit of a bubble. It's all happening really, really fast. But it's nice to look back. It's nice to reminisce. They were great times. But yes, at West Ham, I enjoyed at Wimbledon. Luton was where it all started. So I'd be doing an injustice to the other clubs that I played for if I actually... Everybody knows my love for Celtic and the success I had there and the relationship I had with Martin O'Neill. So if I had to say one, probably Celtic is, you know, the best club that I enjoyed the most, particularly because of the success I had there.
At the end of your career at Celtic, you were managed by Gordon Strachan, and it took him a few days to pluck up the courage to call you to tell you that you were getting transferred to West Ham.
I know. Well, it was pretty common knowledge that we'd won the league, and I think that the club wanted to move on several players. They'd already moved on Alan Thompson, they'd moved on Chris Sutton, and I think the club were quite prepared to move me on. And I went on holiday, and I was on holiday in the summer thinking I'd go back to Celtic. I'd one more year left on my contract, and I received a phone call. I was like by the swimming pool, and my wife and a couple of kids and that were there, and I remember my phone going, and I went on to Gordon Strachan, and he said, "Oh, John, really sorry, son," he said, "but I've agreed a deal to sell you to West Brom." He said, "You've been great for me last season. We won the title in his first season." He said, "But I just feel I want to go down a different, a different style, different way of playing." And he said, "I've agreed with Brian Robson at West Brom to let you go. He said, the fee is £500,000. And I really wish you all the best. He says, you know, let's stay. And I keep in touch with Gordon now. Everything's fine. No issue with that. And then I went to West Brom with Brian Robson, who again was somebody that I had the utmost respect for. A great player, a great man, and a lot of time for Brian. And then at West Brom, I feel I just lost my way a little bit. I was in a difficult place mentally. I was gambling a lot. I'd put a lot of weight on. There was a pub right opposite where I lived. I was probably drinking too much. And then it just all seemed to hit me at once. Well, I was thinking, well, I'd gone through a divorce. I wasn't seeing too much of my kids, which was heartbreaking. I was driving from Birmingham back down to Swansea every couple of weeks to see them. That played its toll heavily on my physicality, and difficult to leave Swansea at 6 a.m, drive straight to the training ground and then train. I haven't had 3 hours in the car, heavy on your legs and everything else like that. So it all came on top, really. And at that particular time, I was definitely feeling the ill effects of something going on. And I just feel, ultimately, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer that spread to my lungs and onto my brain. And maybe it was the pressures of the realisation of my career's come to an end. I'm in a lot of debt. I'm out of control. I'm gambling. I'm drinking. I'm heavy. I'm skipping training. And it just all became too much. And ultimately, then I got in the team and I got out of the team, and manager situation changed. I was sent out on loan to Norwich for a month. Ultimately, I feel all that pressure, all that stress I was bringing on myself, and had brought on myself over a number of years, took its toll. And then I just hit a wall. Coming through that period has certainly been, you know, a big wake-up call. And a chance for me to have put things right and to now live the life that I'm living.
Let's talk about your international career, because you made your debut for Wales in 1993. 51 appearances for your country. How much did that mean to you to represent Wales?
Huge. And I wanted to get to 50. I think to have got to 50 caps, not many do it. You get a golden cap when you get to 50. And I probably had a few more caps in me, to be honest. Again, I had issues with the managers. One or two managers there, Bobby Gould in particular, God bless him. I like Bobby now, we get on really well whenever we see each other. Again, I blame myself because he left me out of a few squads and he left me out of a few games where I felt I should have been playing, and maybe I should have just kept my mouth shut, but I didn't. I went in to see him and then all of a sudden walking away from it and things like that, and falling out with Bobby, and then... So I reckon there was a good 20 caps more in me. I think I should have got 70, not 50-odd. But I absolutely loved playing for my country. I'm a very, very passionate Welshman, very patriotic about where I come from. I speak the language. I give my heart and soul for my country. Whenever I wore that that red shirt with number 9 on the back, I had heroes before me. You know, Dean Saunders, Rush, Hughes, Trevor Ford, John Charles, these guys, and for me to have led the line, you know, as a centre forward for the amount of time that I did, it gives me enormous pride to think that I did that for my country and my children, obviously Welsh speaking, my eldest two, and I love Wales, I love Swansea. I moved up to Edinburgh, but I went back to Wales to get all my treatment and everything else in the hospitals. But playing for Wales was definitely the highlight of my career.
I watched you as a teenager from the North Bank. You're a real hard guy of football. You had this reputation. Obviously, you've said that you had a bit of a fiery personality at that time, but hard on the pitch as well, very physical player. But that's not the man that I know now, that I've sort of got to know since, professionally and personally.
Well, I don't think it was the man even back then. It was like when... What it was that I was very competitive and I wanted to win. And if that, you know, when I trained even, I loved that physicality. I loved that body contact, you know, backing in. I loved gritting my teeth. Do you know what I mean? And I liked, if a centre half came and smashed me in the first minute, I thought that was great, because I've got to get him back now. You know, I hated it when centre halves tried to befriend you and how's it going? You know, how's the kids and all? How are you getting on? I hated that because I didn't want to be his friend. Do you know what I mean? I just loved that physicality. I loved the body contact, and you know, me and Martin Keown used to go hammer and tongs in training. We used to just, because Martin would always say, John, if you can get the better of me today. And Martin was 10 years older than me, a lot of experience, played for England, Everton, Villa, Arsenal, great player, really tough, strong centre half. And we roomed together, and we would go out to the training ground, and he'd say, right, we'll do it for real today. Me and you, as if it's proper. And I'm thinking, well, if I can get the better of Martin Keown, I can get the better of anybody, because there weren't many better than Martin, if any. He was a top, top player. That's how we used to do it. But I'd like to think I've always been a people's person. I've always had time for people. You know, and sometimes you get this little bit of reputation. And when I go around now, when I do after dinner talks and hospitality lunches and corporate dinners, and people meet me, and you just got this persona. I think we're all very judgmental of people, aren't we?
But then are people surprised when they meet you?
They are, very much so. They say, well, you know, you're quite softly spoken, and you're a decent guy. And I'm like, well, what did you expect? But maybe I give that image out. And it's like a lot of people, when they write a book, you know, they write a book, and a lot of what's in the book is exaggerated tenfold. Especially when, like, my cancer story, it's all there. You know, that is plain and simple. I told it exactly how it is. But, you know, when people sort of sometimes do interviews, they try and come across as people that they're not. I always try and be just very normal. I'm from a council estate in Swansea. I've never forgot my roots, never forgot where I come from. I'm still John, that boy that left at 16 years of age to go and live the dream and try and make it as a professional footballer. Seems an awful long time ago now, but I've always remained very humble.
Since retiring from football, John Hartson has fought a well-documented battle against cancer, which almost killed him. But he also has a terrible gambling addiction, which got so bad that he says that also could have killed him.
It was no blame on it, it was just me. It was just something that got into my head, and it became an issue. It became an issue. I was playing fruit machines. I became an addict very early on. And then when you get a little bit older, I was playing the one-arm bandits. When you get a bit older, a bit more famous, when I started to earn decent money with the football clubs I was at, you don't really want to be walking into betting shops with a lot of cash in your hand. People stare, they look at you, and so you open up accounts, and they're the worst things, accounts, because it's not real money in your hand, you know, it's on an account, and it doesn't feel the same when you walk into a bookmaker's with a load of money, or whether you do it on the phone. It's just mentally, it's just not quite the same, but it's just as easy, if not easier. So it spiralled out of control. And don't get me wrong, I had a great life. I lived in beautiful houses and I had the best cars and lovely holiday destinations, and didn't affect anybody around me. You know, they were all looked after as well. But for me, I hit rock bottom when I came out of hospital, when my wife said to me that she could no longer sit back and watch me put myself through what I was putting myself through. She thought too much of me, it was killing her. And she said, you also won't put me and our girls through it. So that was a huge moment for me. That was the rock bottom. And from that day, October the 5th, 2011, 7 years now and 2 months, that was my last bet I placed. And I've not even so much as bought a raffle ticket since. I've really got into the programme. I wouldn't say I'm anti-gambling, because not everybody who gambles is an addict. And for me, it just became a real problem in my life, problematic. Everything revolved around the gambling. It controlled my life. I woke up in the morning, I got my bets on, it controlled my moods, it controlled everything. And in the end, it controlled the fact that I couldn't pay my bills. So that was a disaster. It caused me so many disasters. I just didn't want it anymore. I just got sick of it, to be honest. And I just decided to stop. That was me. I'm not doing this anymore. I want to save my marriage. I want to save my relationship, my kids. And to do this, I've got to knuckle down. I've got to knuckle down, and I've got to show a bit of self-control and a bit of desire and a bit of fight. And that's what I've been able to do. And I went to Gamblers Anonymous in Swansea in a meeting. And I went there and I continued to go twice a week. My wife came with me. She went to Gammonon, which is next door, where the mums of the problematic gamblers and the wives and the sisters and the family members go into a separate room. They discuss issues that they are dealing with the gamblers. They join the meeting for the last half an hour and you all talk as a group. I got some brilliant advice. I got some amazing feedback and help from the other the other compulsive gamblers that were in that room, especially the experienced ones who'd gone years without betting but kept going to help the newcomers. And it's the best thing I've ever done. I've got a real focus now in life. And gambling no longer controls that, you know. And as I said, it's heartbreaking to see people out there that can't quite kick this habit. And as I alluded to earlier on, not everybody who gambles is an addict. People can enjoy a bet. People only have a bet once a month, once a year, twice a week. They gamble with what they can afford. And I would never tell anybody to stop gambling. That's for them to decide that, because nobody could tell me. And I would never, if they ask me for help, I'm in desperate trouble, John. I have just gambled the wedding money. We're getting married in the summer. I've just done 10 grand. I can't believe how could I go home and tell my wife. Get all this all the time, different stories. If they want a bit of advice and a little bit of help, I'll give them that. And if they want to go to a meeting and try and get on top of this gambling addiction, I'll introduce them to the group at the meetings that I go to. But other than that, it's very difficult for me just to tell people to stop gambling. And more recently, I've become an ambassador for Ladbrokes in terms of a campaign that the government are doing and getting behind and supporting in terms of encouraging people to gamble responsibly, seeing the dangers, you know, not getting to a place where I was, if you like. And it's knowing if you're spending too much time in the bookmakers, maybe that extra half an hour a day that you weren't spending 3 months ago, giving them the right information where they can go and get help if they feel it's becoming problematic. Introducing things like Gamblock, you know, banning themselves from their local bookmakers, these type of things. It's all there, all the help is there. There's GA in most cities and counties across Great Britain, Gamblers Anonymous. So there is help there. But it's like everything else, you've got to want to stop, you've got to want to change your life. This is not like a 3 month job where you can just go clean for 3 months. This is forever. People have to realize you cannot ever have a bet again if you want to become clean from gambling. If you don't want to do that and you want to keep gambling and doing your little bits and bobs, that's fine. As long as you can deal with that as a person. So I'm delighted that I've come on board with Ladbrokes. Because one or two people have said to me, oh, John, are you sure? Because, you know, you're 7 years and, you know, and I'm like, being an ambassador for Ladbrokes is something good. It's something positive. You know, it's a positive message that I'm sending out to compulsive gamblers. Gamble responsibly. These are the dangers. These are the pitfalls. And I feel it's something positive. And being an ambassador for Ladbrokes ain't going to make me gamble again. because I've been cleansed. I've totally taken it out of my vocabulary, gambling. Yes, one day at a time, of course, as they say. But I will always be a recovering gambling addict. That will never go away, you know. And when I'm 70, if I live that long, I'll still go to meetings because they give me so much advice, and it's like getting my medicine once or twice a week, you know, seeing the newcomers come in with real problems, helping them get to a place where ultimately the people that I spoke about, the ones who are 10, 15 years without a bet, myself, 7, getting them to that place, if they want help with that is, of course. So it became a real issue for me, caused lots of problems. But being clean, I know I come through the cancer and that's your life. But I will say on record, stopping gambling saved my life. Saved my life.
What made it go from a hobby to an addiction?
Well, I think I was an addict very young. I was an addict very young because I worked in a social club on the council estate. Great club, great people, brilliant. And I used to stand by the drink machines all night, watching people playing the bandits, the drink machines. And then I'd go away, and the boss would walk past. Hey, you, come on, get on your bike. Stop watching them. And I'd go and do half an hour's work. And while I was working, picking up the glasses, the guy on the machine would have like 10 nudges and he'd call for me. He'd say, go and get that kid, go and get that boy, because I'd memorised it all. I'd memorised all the wheels, all the fruits. So I'd come back and I'd say, yeah, mate, it's 2 up there, it's 3 down, it's 1 up, and he'd win the jackpot. And I just used to get a massive kick out of that.
Even though it's somebody else winning the money.
Yeah, and he'd give me like a couple of quid or whatever. He said, there you go, son, there you go. He'd probably give me half my night's wages. But it was that early where, you know, something in my brain, the gambling, it just got me. And and as I said, as I got a bit older, you know, you start betting on horses then. And I had dogs, I had horses. I'd go to the race tracks, and it became like a real social part of what I was doing.
There was a day at Ascot where you backed a horse on its name, didn't you? And you left with a Sainsbury's bag. How much money was in that?
I don't know.
£67,000, according to your book, in a Sainsbury's bag.
Well, the book is exaggerated. No, it's not. No, but I think we had a good day that day, but within about a week, I think I'd give it back.
Oh, well, at times, your debts were pretty catastrophic,
weren't
they?
Well, that's the thing, a gambler, you know, you win one week and you're sharing it all out, and then the next week, you're asking for it back, or you're asking for a loan, or that's what it is, that's what it's like, especially the numbers that you're gambling at, you know, the amounts. So I had a couple of bad days and a couple of good days. I ended up in a lot of debt, and, you know, I had to wave a lot of money away in terms of what I earned. But that was then, and obviously I'm in a great place now, you know, financially, mentally, physically. And one of the main reasons for that is because I'm away from the gambling scene.
Was there a desire for a buzz? Because you talked about wanting to win big money, but you were earning big money a lot of the time.
I think it was the losing takes you back, because you're chasing then and you want to get back what you've lost. And I've heard a lot of people say that. Sometimes when you win, you walk away because you're happy, you've won. You've had a great day and you're on top. When you're losing, you want to go back and win what you've lost back, and then you chase. And then some days, everything will go against you. You know, you'll be 3 furlongs in front, going over the last, and it'll fall. And whatever you do, you can't get it right. I'm sure compulsive gamblers will second that. And you have bad days. Now, my bad day was obviously a huge loss, because I wasn't gambling fivers and tenners. I was gambling in the, you know, the 4-figure sums and things like this, and the 5-figure sums, the monies. So your losses are a lot more as well then. But as I said, that was part of it. I'm willing to talk about it, and I hope by me talking about it will help others. That's ultimately what the interview is about. So we can, you know, we can inspire others with the cancer and obviously the gambling issues and things like that. And I can look back now, and it's, you know, it was an experience at the time. I loved it. It was great. But it's I'm one of the very lucky ones as well to have come through them experiences, and I'm still here to tell the tale.
And for people that are watching, that, you know, maybe they enjoy a gamble, they don't know if they've got a problem or not. Yeah. I mean, there were signs there for you. For example, you were lying to people around you. You stole money on occasions, but lying in the sense that you would call bookmakers up and you had like a secret code.
I had a code. I had a code that they would have to add a zero on to what I was said. So if I'm sitting there with a lot of people, I'd say £10, but it meant £100. You know, that these little things, is what you do. It's what you discuss with the bookies and things like that. But no, I think my message would be to gamblers is to when the fun stops, stop. Which is the ultimate phrase. When it stops becoming fun, and it's affecting your mood, and it's affecting your home life, and your workplace, and all these type of things, it's a real problem. You've got to address that then, because don't get into the pitfalls. Don't go into that black hole where you've lost everything and you're in desperate trouble. It's not a nice place to be. I've been in that place, and it's very dark. And through a little bit of mental strength, also rock bottom, being put in a position where I had nowhere else to do, nothing else to think about apart from getting help for this illness, and it is an illness. So my advice to people would be, recognise when it gets really bad, and take more of a hold of your life when it gets that bad, because, you know, it can get you into a really low place.
And so now, 7 years down the line, your wife controls your finances.
Yes.
So you don't have any temptation there, and she gives you sort of a small amount of cash to carry around with you.
Well, it's working. It's working. And why would I want to change it? If I want anything, if I want a Range Rover tomorrow, I can go and buy one. If the money's there, if I want to go and buy a nice suit, my wife will say, come on, you can have two of them.
I'm guessing it's her peace of mind as well, after
Absolutely.
Everything you guys have been
and
through.
Absolutely. And in the start, 7 years ago, I had to get receipts for everything. And if I went for a pint with my mates, you can always get a receipt. The barman can give you a receipt for that £3 or £4, whatever it was, for a pint. Or if you're in London, £6 for a pint. So these little things are part of what you have to do.
You said that your gambling got so bad that it could have killed you. How would it have killed you?
People take their own lives because gambling becomes so bad.
Were you ever in that place?
No, I never ever considered that. But I was on the verge of losing my wife, because she'd packed her bags and she said that she was going to leave me. That was my rock bottom. So you can be the fourth place you can end up as a compulsive gambler. You can end up out of your house because things have got so bad. So you end up on the streets. You can end up in jail because you've stolen something, and desperate people do desperate things. You can end up dead, because things have got so bad, you're in so much debt that it's been known for people to have taken their own lives because the debt has got so big, and they're in a position of feeling that they can't go nowhere, can't get out of it. They've lost everything. They've lost their wife, they've lost their kids, relationship-wise. They've lost their job. They're in massive amounts of debt. They've ended it. And unfortunately, they've taken their own lives. Or you can end up at GA, which is the fourth place. Them four places you can end up as a compulsive gambler. And through the grace of God, I ended up at GA. So I avoided them other three. That's what they say, Gamblers Anonymous. Whoever chairs the meetings will tell you that. It's the four places you can end up. So when I say I could well have been in jail, or I could have been dead, I've just explained the reasons why.
You don't get closer to death than John Hartson did. A lump on his testicle, which he ignored, turned out to be cancer, which spread. Things got so bad that at one point in hospital, he stopped breathing and had to have emergency brain surgery to save his life.
Well, I first found a lump probably 4 years before I even got it checked. There was a lump at the bottom of my testicle, and it was there over the years. I just felt it there, and it slowly got a little bit bigger. It turned from like a little small nut size to probably like more of like a baked bean size, which is quite a difference. And eventually I spoke to my wife about it, and I said, I'm a little bit concerned here with this. And she says, go and speak to the doctor.
And she couldn't even feel it?
No. She said, go and speak to the doctor. I didn't. I told her, a little white lie. I said, I'd been to the doctor, but I hadn't. And I said, everything was all right. Because at that time, I was starting to panic a little bit. I was thinking, there's something not right. And then what happened was, over a period of time, that lump was a tumour, cancerous tumour. And then over the next couple of years, it spread from my testicular cancer. It spread to my lungs and onto my brain. And then when I was eventually diagnosed, I was in quite a bit of trouble then, because they had to deal with the brain, the lungs. Cancer had spread all over my body, and I went into hospital, and I spent 6 weeks. I had two brain operations, had a load of chemotherapy sessions, and I nearly died. I nearly died because of my ignorance, really, of my health. So my message is to people, you know, if you feel any lumps at all, it's very important you go and get them checked. Don't ignore the signs. Do not ignore the signs, because it can spread. It can spread into certain parts of your body. And then I had, it spread up to my brain. So I had two emergency brain operations. I had a load of chemotherapy to take the cancer cells to try and kill them horrible red cancer cells that are swarming around your body. But also it attacks the chemotherapy, it attacks the white, shiny cells that keep you alive, keep your immune system going. I had a few issues on the ward. I had pneumonia. I couldn't stop coughing at one stage, and it looked very, very bleak. It looked as if the pneumonia was going to take me, and I stopped coughing. I did a lot of praying, strangely enough, because I wasn't a particular church goer. But I started to pray for my life. I started to pray, you know, please God, you know, give me this chance, and let me live for my kids, and all these type of things I used to say to myself when I was on my own. And I knew there was a lot of people praying for me as well, you know, the whole Celtic family, the other general people, football supporters were very helpful and very encouraging. Sending lots of emails and telegrams and flowers and everything, cards to the hospital in Swansea. The two hospitals, Morriston and Singleton, were just overwhelming in terms of the support. The cameras weren't allowed in. They gave me all the privacy, and the work that they did with me to get me back well, the chemotherapy program that I had to enter into. They would put me into a little private room, so I couldn't be seen, sat out with, not that I would have minded sitting and having my chemotherapy with all the others. They just made it that little bit more comfortable for me and my family, which I'll never forget, you know, the times that they did that for me. They pulled out all the stops. So that was a really tough one, you know, at the time. I didn't know whether I was going to live or if I was going to die. My wife was extremely worried. She was pregnant, and we had two little small ones. So it was a tough time, really, for the whole family, my immediate family and my parents, of course. The hospital, I had loads and loads of visitors, and everybody was very supportive. So I was really blessed and very, very fortunate to have come through that period of my life. And it's totally changed me as a person. it's totally changed my outlook on everything now. That break that I had, that lucky break that I had in terms of not passing, it's made me appreciate things a lot more. Time with my children and just life in general, really. I'd like to think that it was an experience for me personally, which ended up a really good one, because maybe if I hadn't have come through that, then I wouldn't have raised £900,000 for the John Hartson Foundation, which is very close to my heart, to set up the charity foundation. We get great support. We fill out all the venues. Every single penny we make, we put back in to the hospitals and the hospices, and we give it to great causes. We really, really make a difference. And that's something that it's better than scoring any goal, playing at any stadium for any club. When I go with that check and, I give that check to the hospitals and I see the sick children, I go to the cancer wards, that is what does it for me. That is what makes me want to stay, keep doing it, keep raising money for great causes, keep saving people's lives, helping others. Because, 9-10 years ago, I nearly lost my life. Somebody saved my life, and I can never, ever repay them back for that. So the best way I can do things is to do the charity, to raise the money. And by doing that, I feel as if I'm giving something back. I'm doing something very, very positive. So that's become a big feature now as well. You mentioned earlier on about missing the football. I've got my charity stuff to deal with as well. I phoned two people up yesterday. I get emails all the time. Can I go and visit this one? Can I go and speak to this one? About the gambling, about the cancer. I can't physically be everywhere, but I certainly do as much as I can to help people.
You ignored the lump for a long time, and it was eventually crippling headaches, really bad headaches that caused you a problem, and not very nice vomit as well. Mm. You went to A&E, and there's about 4 to 5 weeks of your life that you basically have no recollection of.
You were
out of it.
I was gone. I was out of it. My wife, my parents tell me, the hospital was just loaded with visitors and friends and people that I've known for a long time. My sister did a brilliant diary while I was in hospital, which eventually went into the book. Victoria was always, when John gets better. It was never like, if John comes through, or if John is to ever, it was always when John gets better. So that was brilliant. Every was so positive.
But it was touch and go, wasn't it?
It was touch and go, yeah.
You know, you stopped breathing at one time.
Yeah, I stopped breathing. And my wife said it was like a scene out of, it was just like a scene out of one of these emergency wards where the patient comes in and then or to put it in a better way, it's like when you see the when the line flashes and it just goes so that's the sign. And she was looking at that. My father collapsed. It was just bedlam at the time. So all these things that I was unaware of. My mother had a little moan at the nurses because I'd got myself out of bed and I'd ran away. I was pulling all the wires. I'd gone off, I was out of it on all the medication. And I fell and I banged my eye on one of the corner tables and I had a big black eye at one stage. So my mum, being a mother, she was having a go look at his eye. I can't believe you let him bloody run out the ward. And so it was all at one stage, it was all up and down, good news, bad news, theatre, operations. It was just a mixed, episode of emotions. So when I came out of that and to see where I am now, 9 years on, healthy, few scars on my head, but I can live with the few scars, I suppose. So, it makes me very proud to think that I've come through that and what I've done with the charity. It's something good that I've done.
In the darkest days in hospital, what was it that kept you going?
My kids, I think. My kids and the people really close to me, I think. because there were only four or five people that were named that were allowed into the room because of risk of infection. So that was my parents, my wife, my brother, I think. The kids couldn't come in.
But your eldest kids were old enough to understand. It must have been...
Yeah, they were old enough to understand. And they were 10 and 7, I think. And I can't remember now. Rebecca's 19 now. So I could see their little faces through the window, you know. That was horrific. So it was the kids, things like that, you know. When you bring the kids up and everything, and it's like, oh my God, I can't believe this. I'm 30, 33, I think, something like that. I think, you know, they're going to lose their dad and all that. So you get all these thoughts, and one day you have a bad day, the other day, like, you have a positive day and things like that. So your emotions are all over the place. During this time as well, you're on heavy medication. So it was not a nice experience, to say the least. And I know my heart goes out to everybody there's somebody today now, this minute, going in for an operation. There's somebody that's diagnosed with cancer now. You know, and it'll happen tomorrow, it'll happen next week, it'll happen in 3 weeks' time. Cancer doesn't discriminate. It's an awful, awful situation. And I know that there's many people out there that are suffering.
You've mentioned the John Hartson Foundation, which has the main aim of knowing your balls, I think, is your catchphrase.
Yeah. Grab life by the balls.
Grab life by the balls. Men can do that, of course. but as part of that, you did the Full Monty.
Yes.
On mainstream TV.
Yeah.
I've not laughed so much in a long time. You were brilliant. Did you enjoy it?
It was great. It was really, really good. It was something that is close to my heart when they asked me to do it. It was an awareness campaign where we were raising awareness of men's cancer, and in particular testicular cancer. So we had to have 12 training sessions with Ashley Banjo, who is just an absolute incredible specimen of a man. You know, he'd come in every morning and he'd do a handstand, and he'd go up on his arms, his feet would be in the air, and he'd be doing all these stretches, and he's so strong, so professional, and an absolute diamond of a man. So he choreographed it all. And what people don't know is, I'm letting people into a little secret, is that the stage was like marked for you individually. So you've got to go forward, and you've got to move to your left, and the person to your right's moving to your inside, and you go back, and you're down on the floor. And it took sort of best part of 10 sessions in London. So I have to fly down from Edinburgh, go to a dance studio. They'd be in Tottenham Court Road, all different parts of London, whatever the guys could all get there. You remember, you're talking about 6 or 7 guys here in the show: Jeff Brazier, Arj from The Only Way Is Essex, great lad. Ashley, they've all got their things going on. Tom from the band The Wanted. Ainsley Harriet, who's busy. Apologise if I've let that. Hugo Monnier, the rugby player, works for BT Sport. So it was difficult getting everybody together on one particular morning, but we all got behind it. We knew it was going to be huge. I think there was like 5 million people that watched the show. We did it in the original theatre in Sheffield, where the original Full Monty film was filmed. And it was warts and all. It was everything off. It was everything off.
We saw, John.
Yeah, you can imagine the rehearsals and everything else. And but it was great fun, and it was for a brilliant cause. And I've since spoken to people, and they've said, John, while the adverts were on that night, I went to the toilet and I checked myself. So the amount of awareness we raised that night of the show. And that's what it all was about, because it is the awareness. It's people knowing what to feel for and to go immediately, because early intervention with cancer in particular can save your life. It stops the cancer from spreading. It stops it from going to other parts. If you can get on top of it and nail it down and get the right treatment in the right place, it makes such a huge difference. Don't leave it, you know, don't let it spread like I did, which nearly cost me my life. So it was great awareness. It was watched by millions of people, so much great feedback. People calling you brave and inspirational, but I was only doing something that might just help one person, you know, and we've all got one.
Entertaining is what I would call it.
It was entertaining, and it was a great show. It was packed, 2,000 people in the theatre, and a really good show, and I'd like to think that we nailed it.
You did, you did. It's so good to catch up with you today, and so well, and happy and everything. What does the future hold in terms of work? You're obviously doing a lot of punditry at the moment, but do you have managerial ambitions?
Well, I've been an assistant manager. I worked a little bit with David Hopkin last season at Livingston, who'd got two promotions. They now play in the top flight, the Scottish Premiership. I've been assistant manager of Wales with Chris Coleman. Never really took to that role, really. It didn't inspire me, if you like. I wasn't involved enough, and take nothing away from the group of players and what Wales achieved, absolutely fantastic. I've mentioned I'm a proud Welshman earlier on. But the assistant manager thing, I didn't quite take to it. So management, I don't know. As the years are ticking now, I'm thinking maybe not. I think, you know, I've got one or two different gigs going on at the minute. I enjoy the media. I've been doing the media now for the best part of 10 years. I've done some big ones, you know, BBC. I've done all the big shows. Still working on big shows, of course, for BT Sport. I enjoy that. Do like the media. But unless it was probably something that I could really get my teeth into, and it's a job that I thought, yes, you know, this is really, really something I could go and do and do it justice and make an impact. I don't know. You don't know really what's around the corner, do you? But stay healthy, of course, is the main one as well. Stay healthy, and, you know, just to remain busy and to keep going, because I think people have said to me that try and remain busy, you know, keep activities is good if you've got to get on a plane, and luckily for me, my diary is full. Phone's ringing all the time, which is great.
You've said you're only 43, you've got a lot of life ahead of you, but it's been pretty eventful so far. How would you sum up your life so far?
Ups and downs, but more ups, a lot more ups. You know, the birth of my 5 children was just, you know, was just the best feeling any father could have. I've had a wonderful football career. My chosen profession, I got to the top. I played at the very highest level. My second chosen profession was the media. I've got to the top in that. So, you know, I've beat cancer, which again is my life. You know, it's my life. So it's been eventful. It's been great. It's been enjoyable. I've met some wonderful people. You know, during my life, I've travelled the world. You know, and I'm still doing it. So, I would sum it up as, you know, ups and downs, but more ups.